sending me that message. All right. Once again, I'm here with Tess Hughes from Galway, Ireland. And Tess is was one of the people who had I had seen on Consciousness TV. I was kind of introduced to her through Bob Ferguson, whom I interviewed here before. And so you guys all probably remember that and have listened to that recording as well. But right now I'm going to introduce, once again, Tess Hughes from Galway, Ireland. And Tess, please tell us about yourself and tell us your story.
Hi, everybody. Hi, Lynn. Let me see, where will I start? I'll start by telling you that in 2003, I Googled the name of my first boyfriend from when I was a teenager. His name was Richard Rose. I didn't find anything about Richard Rose, but I came upon the site of the Cat Foundation, which was a group founded by Zen master or awakened man called Richard Rose. And I was so, something about the writing on that front page of the TAT website really, really struck me. It was like my mind was stopped. I could understand every word. I could read the sentences, and yet I knew I wasn't getting the point of it. I knew there was something I wasn't getting. So I spent maybe a half an hour doing that, and then I went to bed. And I was really baffled by this. I'm wondering, what was that? What kind of writing is this that would has words? There's obviously something in it, and you can't get it. So the following morning I got up, and as soon as I awoke, I was still thinking about this, and I was still sort of baffled or stunned or something. So I went to the computer again and read it again, and I read further on, and it still had the same effect on me, that I knew I wasn't getting what was being said, and yet I was incredibly attracted to this kind of writing and these sentences. It was kind of a clarity or a truth in it that I just had not come across before. So I then started over time, you know, going into links. There were other websites linked to it, like Bob Ferguson and Art Tickner and so on. They also had been producing a magazine, a spiritual magazine, we call it, the TAT Forum, since the early 70s. And they had huge archives of this, and it came out every month. So I signed up for that. And I would get it every month with, you know, whatever, different kind of stuff in it. So for about almost 2 years, I would say that pretty much every day or 7 days a week, I went back to those websites. I was always following up on something and trying to find out about this Richard Rose guy and what kind of guy he was. And it was just so attractive to me. So I decided then that I would go to one of their weekends, which at that stage they held in West Virginia, in the original farm that Richard Rose had set up. And I told some people, and they thought I was quite crazy. You know, what are you doing? You know, going to some group in West Virginia that has a website? You know, it's probably a cult or something like that. But I had to find out for myself. I had to go and see them in person and check out. Were they really as authentic as it seemed to me in the writings? So I flew to Boston, and a friend of mine came with me from Boston. He said, God, you know, you better not go there on your own. And we spent the weekend there. And I was even more impressed after the weekend. And I suppose the thing that I saw, the word that I used to myself was integrity. What I found was integrity. Now, from when I had been young, I had always had an idea that there were people of integrity and people who were not of integrity. And along the way, I had come to realize that, you know, integrity isn't something that happens just as you get old. You just don't automatically become a person of integrity just by growing old. You had to consciously do something about, you'd say, developing character or something, you know, becoming a person of integrity. So that had been a goal of mine. I had always been working towards that. So it was amazing for me to find a whole group of people, not just the ones who had an experience, but the students who were there. There was just this sense of integrity about everything. So when I went back to Ireland, Art Tickner emailed me and started a correspondence with me, and that made a profound difference to me, to have this, you know, once a week or once a couple of weeks, whenever he would write to me or I would write to him, and he would there would be a sentence or a statement or a question or something, or there would be something that would be correcting a wrong assumption I had in it. Actually, Art produced a book recently. It's called Beyond Relativity, and I got a copy of it. And, you know, I was looking through it, and I thought, I recognized this stuff. It was sentences like this that he dropped into emails to me over the 5 years after that. So drip by drip, these questions or these questioning of assumptions or this kind of thing. So it was really like self-inquiry that was done through email. And it really just changed what I had been doing before that, and changed my understanding of what it was that I thought I had been doing, and it cleared up a lot of ideas for me, and so on.
So, tell me about you studied this stuff from these other people for years, and you finally got in contact with them and had a conversation with them and started learning from Art. So tell me about your personal experiences that went along while this was going on. I'm assuming that you were still living at home with your husband and family, and yeah, and being maybe a housewife, how did this work for you?
Well, my daily life didn't change at all. I mean, I just, as I said, lived with my husband and went to work and just did whatever. And nobody around me noticed anything or saw anything. There was no difference in me. One of the things that I understood for myself was that self-inquiry was a very private matter. It was a matter between me and myself, so to speak. And it wasn't anything to be talked about. In fact, when I did try to speak with people about anything, everybody seemed to, well, people didn't think I was on a spiritual path at all. Whereas, you know, there were a lot of my friends and so on would be on various things they called spiritual paths, and they just didn't attract me. They just seemed kind of soft by comparison with what Tat was saying, which was a much more challenging, personally challenging kind of thing to be doing. So I never talked about myself as being on a spiritual path or even really realizing that I was. I was just, I suppose I had an idea like, know thyself, to thine own self be true. That would have been from when I was a teenager, from Shakespeare in school. I remember that sentence, to thine own self be true, for then it follows as the night, the day, that canst not then be false to any man. And I was about 16 or 17 when I heard that sentence, and I was really struck about it, because I knew that I wasn't true to myself, but I didn't know how to get to be true to myself. But then I got, I suppose from Tat, it was the first time I got the idea that, well, what is the self? You know, what is the self that you might be trying to be true to? And maybe you're thinking in a wrong way or something about that. So yeah, I began to have other ideas about what the self was or what that might be. And the idea that what was stopping me from being true to myself were false beliefs, or beliefs and assumptions and expectations and things like that. So I suppose that's really what I got from Art, and from the whole Tat group. Art happened to be the one who emailed me, but I mean, I would always be reading the other stuff, and this kind of message was repeated again and again. You know, what are your assumptions about that? What are your beliefs? Now, I had not thought of doing that kind of thing before. So I would be just, you know, vacuuming the house or washing the dishes or walking the dog or something, and I would be thinking about something like that, or something would come up, that would make me realize I'd had an assumption or an expectation.
So you were doing...
Prior to that time, I wouldn't have thought like that.
So you were doing some very deep mind watching and listening to your own thoughts and making having a discernment about what kinds of thoughts you were having. Were you noticing that the thoughts, maybe some of them seemed to be not your own thoughts, and maybe some of them seemed to be just random thoughts that came into your mind?
There were both kinds. One of the things I found was that I had no thoughts that were my own at all. They had all come from somebody else.
Yes.
They had all come from the world around me. And just then, along with that was came the understanding that that's what the conditioning is. That every thought you had, every description, every whatever expectation or anything that you had come from outside. And in particular, when I turned this on myself in relation to, any statement I might have made about myself, I had gotten it from someplace else. It hadn't come from within me, it had come from outside. But as this was going along over some period of time, I also began to notice that there were other thoughts that came that seemed to be of a different order or had a different quality about them. And I also had the idea that what I was looking for was within me. And it had always been there, and I wasn't noticing it. So there was something that I wasn't noticing. So I became very sharp and discerning about any emotion or feeling or thoughts that were going by. So, as I said, I began to have noticed that there were thoughts that just seemed to come out of the blue. That actually developed over time, and that's what I call intuition. There were certainly thoughts that hadn't come from the world, and they were surprising. To me, at first, but I did know there was something significant about them, or a possibility there was something significant, because if you're looking within yourself to find what it is you're not noticing, I suppose I'd started noticing something more. And I found the more attention I paid to such thoughts, the more they developed, in the sense of more of them came, and maybe it was that I noticed them more. And of course, at the same time, the beliefs and the assumptions and so on were also getting eradicated, because as I checked them, I found they really didn't have any proper validity. They were just conditioning. So I suppose as they died down or became less or didn't have as much of a hold on the mind, that the intuitive thoughts became more obvious to me. That was part of the stage that was going along.
So were you surprised to be looking at your thoughts and seeing thoughts that didn't seem to come from you? And did you wonder where they came from?
I was surprised by it at first. It became a very familiar part of me then. But at first it was kind of a surprising thing. The other thing was that I didn't keep dream journals or things like that. I have been very poor about documenting anything. But from when I was maybe around, in my 20s even, I was always interested in dreams. So I would have, read about dreams and Jung. I would have read a lot of Jungian stuff and so on. And I had realized that dreams, there were two kinds of dreams. There are dreams that are just about daily life, processing daily life or whatever is going on. But there had always been some other dreams that I realized had symbols in them. And I had a symbol dictionary, and I could look them up, and I would realize that these were of a different order. And I came to think of that was intuition. Because I also found when these intuitive thoughts began to come, that sometimes I would be sort of disbelieving or not knowing what does that mean or something. And I almost always, maybe every time, had a dream that night that showed it the same message in a different way or confirmed in a different way. And so these are both intuition, guidance from within. So guidance from within had started guiding me. Actually, I would say intuition guided me home.
Wow, that is really, really wonderful.
Yeah. And I think that everybody has intuition. And it's just that we either don't notice it, or we overlook it, or I suspect it was there all along. Because some of the dreams I had at different stages in my life, when I look back now, I would be inclined to say, like, intuition was really trying to get through to me. And I was just, I just considered it entertainment. Or, you know, something I, you know, the way you have dreams and you just think, I have no idea what that means. And looking back on them, I would say they were definitely trying to get something through to me at the time, and I wasn't willing to look.
So talk a little bit then about how this change came over you, and the practices that you did that brought you to that, and then talk about your experience.
Well, I suppose the main practice was learning to look at what was going on in my own mind. What I got were some tools about, you know, say if I'm disappointed about something. Well, you're only disappointed if you had an expectation. So it's like, well, what was the expectation? So learning to find what my expectation was, and then to see, well, is that a valid expectation, and what is it based on, and is that really true, you know, or where is it coming from? Sometimes expectations come from culture, the normal culture things around us, or they might come from in our family, we always did it this way, that kind of expectation. So at first it looks like, you know, psychological work. And it is, I suppose, psychological work. But then that gradually, as I said, developed. Now, there were a couple of other practices that I started doing. Again, I had never heard of such a thing until I came across TAT. One of them was a thing they called isolation retreat. So that meant basically spending a bit of time on your own. And the idea is to stop external stimuli coming in. Because if there's external stimuli coming in, the ego has to keep functioning. That's its job. It has to keep you surviving, you know. So the idea was to, you know, go off and spend a couple of days on your own someplace. So that, you know, you're not getting phone calls, there's no television, you're not having conversations, you're not reading entertaining books or something like that. You're basically shutting down external stimuli, and then what's unprocessed will automatically come up. At least that's how it was with me. One of the recommendations that goes with that is fasting, I suppose. But I knew that I wouldn't be able to fast. I think my own idea anyway is that fasting is easier for men, or more suitable for men, because just their bodies are different. So I just made my own adaptation to it, which was I used to do light eating. You know, I'd bring banana and yogurt and, you know, maybe an egg or something like that. So I would eat a bit through the day so that I wouldn't be starving and weak, and so that I wouldn't be obsessing about food all the time, enough to keep everything going lightly. And just spend, mostly how it worked for me was I would go on a Tuesday morning and come back on a Thursday evening, leave two dinners for my husband. I could fit that in. So I fitted it into my life in a way that didn't cause any disruption. I wasn't like going off for a month someplace. And so I just fitted things into my life with as little disruption as possible. Now, when I started doing it at first, the first time I did it, it's quite upsetting if you've never spent time on your own. And you're not bringing a book, or you're not bringing entertainment. So the first number of times I did it, I found what happened was memories came up that really surprised me, maybe from my teenage years or from my childhood or things like that. And so that went on for a while. And some of them surprised me because there were things I hadn't remembered at all. And I thought, this is going to just keep going on, remembering every time somebody gave out to me when I was a child or something. I would find that I would like live through the upset of, say, sometime I was crying when I was five, And somebody told me, stop crying, there's just too much going on in this household. You know, load of kids and a farm and everything. And it was like as if the emotion had gotten stopped at that moment. But when the memory came back up, I would finish the crying. There'd be maybe a little whimpering or tears for a couple of minutes. And then it disappeared completely. It must have just been, my way of thinking about it was, there were some unprocessed emotions. And when I spent time alone in isolation, they came up and they passed. So that went on for maybe three or four sessions or something like that. And I remember going one time and nothing came up. It's just very silent and very peaceful. At this moment, I just can't remember what happened after that, because I did continue to keep up this practice of going away for a couple of days like that. It'd be about every 6 weeks or something like that. Yes, I think that what happened then was, when I think of it, was I became much more aware of silence and emptiness. It became part of who I was. You know, it came to the fore as opposed to being in the background. And then what happened after that was, my husband became ill. This is 6 years ago. And so I was no longer able to go on isolation retreat or do that kind of thing. Now, you asked me about practices. I just remembered that one at that moment. So I suppose this kind of self-inquiry and some spending time alone and having an understanding as to why I was spending time alone. You know, and I kept going back to the same place, because going back to the same place, initially when you go to a new place, you know, you're afraid of sounds or unfamiliar sounds and all of that, so you don't really settle down. But by going back to the same place again and again, the ego was very used to it, and so it didn't get triggered, so it settled down very quickly. And I think it just built up, just doing that stuff consistently over a period of time, it just built up. What I mean built up was the ego or the conditioning and the unresolved issues from childhood basically died away, and silence and so on came to the fore. And then my husband became ill. He got leukemia, and he was dreadfully ill, and it was just one crisis after another for about 18 months. I was just in and out of the hospital, and I would have told you that I had completely forgotten about the spiritual path at that stage. I just didn't have time to remember it. And after about 18 months, he was at home, and he was pretty well. And one day in the middle of the day, I remembered, I thought, oh my God, I haven't meditated for so long. I'll go and meditate. And this is in the middle of the day, and I sat down to meditate, and I immediately went into the deepest meditation that I had ever experienced, completely. And about 10 minutes later, he called me, and I got straight up out of it and went down to deal with them without having to kind of, you know, adjust or anything like that. And I was really surprised. I just thought, something has really happened here. I don't know what it is. So maybe whatever I had been doing got triggered before Seamus got sick. And then when Seamus became ill, the only practice I had was basically every night before I went into bed to ask for help, to surrender, to accept what happened. Because there were many times when he nearly died during the night. And I would have thought of that as, not my will, but thine be done. So I just consistently said that prayer and just asked for help to accept every day and to surrender to what is, and, you know, things like that. But it would only be, you know, just when I was getting into bed, and the rest of the day I was so busy dealing with what had to be done with. So he got sick in 2008, so 2009. So it was the end of 2009 by the time I sat down that day and had that meditation experience. Then after that, there were certainly things happening. Well, intuition was very much coming through, and dreams were letting me know that there was an inner process happening. It was quite obvious to me there was an inner process happening, but I had no idea how long this would take, or would it be for the rest of my life or anything. But I went on an isolation retreat then in August. Was it at the first week of August in 2010. Now, this was the first time I had gotten away during all the 2 years that Seamus had been in, 2.5 years, actually. And I found a mobile home that was on the grounds of a Tibetan Buddhist temple in the centre of Ireland, up in County Cork. So I went off there, and a couple of days before I went, I was just overcome with the sense that I was going to die. I was going to die before Sunday. This was Friday, and I was going on Sunday. And I just had waves of terror, is all I can tell you. Terror. Like, I felt like I was sweating blood. I don't know how long they would last, 10 minutes or 20 minutes or something. And then they would pass completely, and I would be completely calm, not remember anything about it for maybe 2 hours, and it would happen again. And this kept going on from Friday, from the morning, Saturday, and it happened on Sunday morning, and I was driving to the place, and it's about 2 hours to get there. And it took me about 4 hours, because I had to stop the car and get out on the side of the road and wait for myself to calm down, when a wave of this terror would come. And I was really convinced that the minute I got to this place, I was just begging, the minute I get here, please don't let me crash the car and kill anybody. I just want to get safely there, and then you can have me. Please take me when I get there. And I got there, whatever, Sunday afternoon, and everything was completely calm. It never came back again. And I remember thinking, I was reading a book one of the days during the week, and I was talking about death and this, and I was thinking, oh my God, will I have to go through this again now? I mean, what a pity it didn't all happen when I had this terrible couple of days. You know, there was a missed opportunity. And so be it. You know, if that's the way it's to play out, it's to play out. And then on the Saturday, now there were things happening all week, you know, in terms of visions, and you know, the world would stop, become completely silent, and yet I could hear everything so clearly. So there were things like that happening, and I just was so familiar with and dreams, of course, and I was just so familiar with that. It was much more intense, and or happening through the day, and there was a lot. So I thought, oh, well, this is what happens on isolation retreat. And I packed my bags on Saturday night. I had written Art a letter. I sealed the letter to send to him. And in the morning, I would get up and have a cup of tea and drive home. And I got into bed, I suppose, around midnight. And I do not know whether I turned the light off or on. And as soon as I sat into bed, something started happening, and I knew from the minute it started happening, or the instant, this was it. And I don't remember any of the content of the vision, but what I know was it was rubbing it in my face. See who you are. You are what you are, is the light of consciousness, pure consciousness, without any attributes or whatever. And it was so obvious that that's what I had always been, but I just, you know, it was amazing. It was also an extremely beautiful thing. I was incredibly happy and joyful and love, and just the creativity, the outpouring of creation. It was just, you know, I have no words for it. I cannot tell you. And then it finished, and I turned over and went to sleep and slept, I'd say, for about 8 hours. And I woke up in the morning, and it was as if I had slept on clouds, no dreams or anything. So I knew what had happened. I just knew who I was, and that was it. It was like, how could I never have noticed it before? I knew what what people had been saying about knowing what you are, who you are, what you really are. But I had no words for it. And so I got up the next morning, and I suppose after a while the mind began to try to think what had happened. But the mind was really wiped, and it was very slow and had very little to go on. And yet I could get in the car and drive home. And over the following week, nobody noticed a thing about me. They said to me, did you have a good holiday? Did you enjoy your holiday? Did you enjoy your breakaway how people saw it and said, oh, that's great, you got a break. And, you know, what had changed was so amazing and profound. I don't know what else to say about it. Ask me anything you want. And
Well, you had said that you, and in the other interview, that you felt like something, you were leaving something behind, and you were trying to remember what it was that you were leaving behind, and it made you physically ill whenever you thought about it, like you were going to throw up.
Yeah, I think that. Do was I chose to. So long. And when I tried to do that, I couldn't do it. And it took me a few hours to realize there's no insight. I couldn't look within because there was no insight. And when I realized that, I also realized that if there's no inside, there's no outside. Because the inside only exists in relation to an outside. Does that make any sense to you?
Wow, that's pretty amazing.
So when there's no inside, there's no outside. So there's just this, just the one. Even saying the one. But I was interesting that there was a physical reaction that whatever couldn't see within because there was no within. I'd forgotten that now until you said it.
So then,
I had very little to say about it for a long time. I could, you know, insofar as I've just described the shall we call it an event or experience, but that was just the event or experience, but the outcome of it or the transformation that happened in it, I suppose it was just speechless. I didn't know what to say or how to say anything about it, and I had forgotten. What had been wiped was everything I had ever read and learned from other teachers or anything. Now, some of that came back slowly over time, but it was quite a slow process. And I'd say it was about 2 years before I got something of a sense of the bigger picture or a sense of the overall thing that had happened. You know, a sense of the process and how it built up or whatever, or broken down, or the breakdown of the ego or whatever. And this has all been written and documented about, and I could see it in relation to the perennial teachings. It was just it gave me words. The perennial teachings gave me words for it. And I was like, oh, that's it. I remember one day, it was about 6 months later, and it suddenly, the phrase, and I had completely forgotten this, was to die before you die. Now, I'd heard people say that, and I thought, what on earth are they talking about? What can that mean, or what would that feel like? And suddenly, one day, as I said, this is about 6 months after that happened, it came into my mind, and I just thought, that's exactly what happened. It was like somebody had, I was just really grateful that somebody had said the words that gave me a way of articulating what had happened. It was like I really knew it and understood it in my experience. Whereas prior to that time, it was like, I really don't know what that's about. So things like that began to come back to me. And it was like, oh, that's what they're saying, or that's exactly how I would relate to it now or understand it. Yeah.
So interesting. So during that time then, you were actually assimilating or somehow settling down for that couple of years?
No, it's about assimilating, because the mind really wasn't functioning much at all. I wasn't able to read. I couldn't even read the spine of a book for weeks. I still don't read. I don't read much anymore. It was interesting because I have a house full of books, and I was so, couldn't stop reading spiritual books and everything like that for so long. And here I was from now on, I couldn't even open them. And nowadays, I really only open a book if somebody asks me, if they ask me about some question, something like that, and I'd be thinking, how would I explain that or describe it? And I might think, gosh, yeah, that was in such and such a person wrote about that. Maybe I'll have a look at that and see, can I find some way to articulate it or some language. So it's just like looking up a dictionary to see how might you, what kind of words might you use around that. But other than that, I actually dislike them. Dislike isn't the word, it's just can't do it. I couldn't watch, couldn't listen to the radio or watch television or anything like that for a long time, for maybe, and it's never really gone away. I just think I'll never again be as interested in the world or be able to, I can take it in small pieces. But there was at least a year when it was just too harsh or gross or things that I loved before, you know. It was a good year later, I remember one day turning on the radio. It was just that silence was so much more joyful and attractive than anything else, even the most beautiful music. Now I've become able to listen to some music and to listen to some things again, but it's still very small amounts. You know, silence is much more attractive, or maybe the longing for it or the desire to rest in it is always the more attractive option. And yet I have no problem if I'm visiting somebody or somebody else's house or something is going on, I have no problem being completely accepting. I don't have to be accepting. There's no thought of being accepting about what's going on. That acceptance is just there. I don't know how to explain it any better, except that I know it's what everybody wants. I know it would satisfy everybody's soul at the deepest level. Yeah. You know, regardless of what circumstances they have or anything like that.
Yes, I believe that completely. Wow. So all this went on. Did your family or friends really notice that much? You know, you're not watching TV, or you're not, you're quiet when we're together, or were you? Did you seem normal to them? It sounds like you were kind of normal to them, where they didn't notice.
Yeah, completely normal. Nobody ever noticed a thing. And my personality remained as chatty and giddy and, you know, as ever. The personality remained just as, you know, I wasn't silent or whatever. But I do really need a lot of time to myself. But my lifestyle allowed me a good bit of time to myself, because, you know, either Seamus was in hospital and I would be in visiting him and I could be at home, or then he'd come home. So I would have hours to myself. I would have time to myself. Or even when he was at home, he'd be sleeping a lot. My life gave me a good bit of time to myself. Nobody noticed any difference in the personality or anything like that. It didn't change at all. And people, Seamus would have the television on a lot, and I would spend some time with him with the television, but I would maybe be in another room when I was in the distance. And it wasn't really a problem. I don't know how that was. It just seemed to be, everything just seemed. It was so. There was no resistance to it. You know, I sometimes say the resistor is gone. There's no resistance to life, whatever life has to offer. The ego is really a resistance to life. It's, you know, saying what's wrong with this, that, and the other, and things should be other ways and so on. But when that goes, then it just isn't there.
Yeah, that's what I've been seeing to my own self, is this idea of just, not even an idea, it's just accept everything.
Yeah.
Just accept everything, yeah. Because why resist? There's no point in it. It's just silliness.
Well, what resists is the ego. And, you know, every time we go along with the resistance, or it's like, what are we feeding? Are we feeding the resistance, or are we feeding an acceptance? I mean, really, again, is it my will or thy will? And it's always my will when there's resistance to something. It's me wanting something and wanting it my way, or wanting some change or improvement. And so that's really what self-inquiry is about, and so on. Taking the zoomph out of the ego and deliberately and consciously acting and behaving in ways that are accepting and just doing it. And it just over time, it's like, you know, I would say that the ego just, it loses its power, it loses its hold. And then, you know, that other process, that process may get a chance to proceed.
So I know that just in the past couple of months, your husband was very ill, and and he did pass away just last month. It hasn't been very long at all.
A couple of months ago, the end of April.
And so, do you want to talk a little bit about that, or if you don't, we can move on.
I don't mind speaking about it at all. Well, he had been ill for over 6 years, and you know, he fought it like anything. He would take any treatment, he would do it then. And he really had a lot of chemo and a lot of illness, and he just got sick a lot. And he just wanted to live no matter what. He was going to do anything. And then a couple of weeks before he died, maybe 2 or 3 weeks, he had become ill. He was back in the hospital, and the doctors said, "This is the end. There's nothing more we can do. We don't have any." The leukemia had come back, and we really don't have any further treatment that we can give you. We've used up all of them. At the various times the leukemia came back, and you know, there is a limited number of medications that are suitable. So he was extremely distraught for 2 days. Absolutely distraught. I mean, he would have taken anything. And then on the third day, he just wanted it over with. Just give me an injection. Just finish me off. Smother me. I don't want to go through this. It's just horrendous. It was very painful to be around him and very upsetting. But I was very lucky because there was the palliative care team and a couple of the nurses. Said to me, just stick with him, just continue to be honest and supportive, and you know, help him come to an acceptance of this. They said he will get through this phase. I wasn't at all confident that he would get through it, or how much I should keep saying, yes, they are saying it's the end, and they won't give any time frame as to when it might be, but there is nothing more they can do, and it's very aggressive.
Oh, just a second. We lost Tess in the almost to the end.
Yeah. So, and he himself, it was like he accepted death, and did he want to stay in the hospital or go to hospice or go home? He said he wanted to come home. So it was arranged within a couple of days that he came home and that I would take care of him. And he spent a lot of time, I mean, he wouldn't be asleep, but he would be awake and sitting up, and he was thinking about death and thinking, he was very much internal, thinking about things. And he began to have experiences. Now, Seamus had very much not been on a spiritual path, and, you know, when I would talk about stuff or say some things to him, whatever, he'd say to me, "I just don't know what you're talking about." Then, about a week before he died, And I said, "Yes." Oh, it was like once he had an experience, he could understand what I had been saying. And it was very comforting to him because this wasn't just some strange, weird, odd thing. There were inner experiences, and he just love and beauty and things. He would say he had a dream, and oh, so beautiful. And 3 days before he died, he said to me, "Seamus is gone." I said, "Where is he gone? I mean, who's gone? Who are you talking about?" And he said, "His name is Seamus Mulligan. He's gone." I said, "It just wandered off. We won't miss him." You know, now you know yourself from being somebody who knows the teachings and the readings and scriptures, so on, knows about, you know, when the ego, the death of the ego. Now, Seamus didn't know that language and wouldn't have understood that language, but that's exactly what he was saying. And that was 3 days before the end. And then, you know, he was just very courageous in facing into it. But he was also, he just talk about the love and the beauty, that it was just so wonderful. And the other thing that happened, and this wasn't just to me, before that he talked about death as the end, you know, annihilation, or there was nothing, a blank wall or whatever. He started talking about the transition I'm going through. That was his language. Now he didn't have pain, so he didn't have to be medicated. So he was completely clear. He knew exactly what was happening with him, and a lot of times that he looked like he was sleeping, there were certainly things going on, because he would say something that he knew that had been internal stuff happening with him. Then on the Saturday evening at 6 o'clock, he said to me, speaking in Irish, which was the language he spoke mostly, the Gaelic language, and he said to me in Irish, "I'm going for the long sleep. You have a short one now. The long sleep." So he kind of settled. Now, I don't know how he settled, because he wasn't really moving at that stage or anything, but some kind of as if he settled. And his breathing was completely rhythmic and strong at the time. And by about an hour later, somebody came into the house and said, "He's dying, this is it." And that rhythmic breathing continued until 11:30, and it just got lighter and lighter. There was a disruption in the breathing or anything. And there were about 15 people in the room. And he was just like a little boy sleeping peacefully. And just gradually, and the breathing stopped. And we were standing there with just the peaceful look on his face. And everybody who was there were very moved. And most people had not seen anybody dying before, and really felt that it had made them feel that dying doesn't have to be terrible. That it was easy. Everybody just said, "That's how I want to go." It was like a very beautiful unconscious death. And that, I just couldn't stop but being happy for Seamus. I know I've lost him, and we had a great relationship and great friendship we had and everything, but I cannot stop but being happy for him the way it ended. It was the best possible ending after 6 years of such hardship and suffering and everything. I'm still happy for him. That's mainly what I feel.
You mentioned something about even the priest who came could see.
A priest had come, and he'd only gotten to meet us like during the last week, and it was the week of the resurrection, because it was the week just after Easter here, and he had mentioned to me when he came after that Seamus had died during the week of the resurrection, which is, as he said, it's very significant, and you know, that he said Seamus underwent the resurrection. I said, "Yes, I know." It wouldn't have been the language I used, but that's exactly what he was saying. So I asked him, I said, "Well, you know, you see people dying all the time. Does this happen often?" And he said, "Surprisingly often." I think that was his phrase, "or more often than you'd think." But he said, "Mostly the families don't understand what's happened." Now, I haven't had a chance. Now, I asked him, how did he know this? Because he was not with us in the last couple of days. And he said, "I knew by the body." I haven't met him since. And when I do, I'll ask him, how was it that he could look at the body and see? Now, Seamus did have a very peaceful look on his face. Maybe that was enough. You know, there was a semi-little smile there, just a peaceful look. So perhaps it was that he could see. And he had seen the cams. So, when he came, you know, during the week, I mean, complete calmness, and it was a real silence. The house was very silent that last week, despite the fact that there were visitors and talk and everything. There was this air of silence around. So perhaps that, but I've always suspected myself that many people must awaken when they're dying. You know, when they accept the death, accepting death, whatever it is that allows us to accept death, is really an acceptance of the end. The ego has finally given up. The survival mechanism has bowed to something greater. It's just disintegrated. So I suspect that this must happen to many people who are dying. Just naturally, it seems to me that it's a natural movement. unless people are so medicated that their minds are not, that they don't know. I don't know.
Really, how could you know? And how could anyone know? What do you think about death? What are your thoughts about what happens, or where do we go, or where did he go?
Well, the only thing that dies is the ego. And when the ego dies, what's left is consciousness. So all that dies is the body and the mind. But we're not the body and the mind to begin with. That's the whole problem. We're misidentified. We think something that we're not. And that's what causes all the pain and horrific. The end of us. But when you see that that's just an instrument. That's just a tool for use in the world. But what we are is consciousness. And of course, consciousness doesn't die.
So do you have any notion that your Seamus is still has a personality? Or is just sheer consciousness? Do you have any sense of him? There's a problem. Can you hear me?
Some kind of unique or some way. So I think one would just know that they had been this instrument. Consciousness knows everything, so it would know. The ego was gone 3 days before he died. He himself said Seamus was gone. So Seamus was gone.
Wow.
So what was left?
What is left, yes.
Consciousness with a body that's dying. But if you're not that body, big deal if it dies. When I'm saying big deal, I'm being sarcastic there. It's not a big deal when it's just an instrument.
Absolutely. And so I'm sure that you haven't, or maybe you have thought now more, what are you thinking about now as far as, there, I lost her again. Let's see, are you back? Oh, this thing is not working so good. Let me...
We're back.
Okay, good. So I was asking you about, what is happening with you now? Are you, I know that with the TAP Foundation, a lot of the folks that I've seen there are very actively teaching or being involved with people. What are you thinking about, or what is your guidance? What is your intuition?
I don't really know. I have a website, tesshughes.com, and for the last couple of years, I would write an article or put it up. Now, I haven't been able to do that for the last several months on account of Seamus. So the only things, I actually put up a memorial to Seamus on it one day. And Richard Lang of the Douglas Harding Foundation in England, I had invited him to come and do a workshop on seeing. I don't know if you know their work, if you know Douglas's work. What he called it was seeing. It's like a shift in perception from egoic seeing to seeing from the point of view of consciousness or something like that. It's like a meditation technique is how I would describe it. Now, as well as doing all the TAT stuff, I had also... I had gone to England to a Douglas Harding workshop in 2007, and I had learned this technique. So as well as doing self-inquiry, I was doing seeing all the time. If I wasn't doing one, I was doing the other. I was constantly reminding myself throughout the day, oh, seeing now, or because I would keep forgetting it. That's the thing. So I would have to do things. So I would be doing that, or I would be doing the self-inquiry, or I'd be doing the solitary retreat. I was always at something. And... I really feel it contributed enormously. I really found, because I was never a disciplined person who could sit and do my meditation for a half an hour every morning and a half an hour in the evening. So my many years of 30 years of learning different meditation techniques, I'd do them for a week or two and forget about the big gone. I'd try another one. But somehow with this one, because you could do it throughout the day, you know, when you're vacuuming the house or whatever it is. So I thought, this is the one for me. I can do this throughout the day and I don't have to feel bad because I miss my half an hour in the morning. So I found that to be such a beneficial and such a wonderful practice and so beneficial to me that I had asked Richard if we could come and do a day's workshop in Galway. So that's happening on the 5th of July. And then in the 12th to the 14th of September, do you know Bart Marshall?
No, I don't.
You know the name? Bart Marshall also is from the TAT Foundation.
I'll have to look for him.
And his partner, Deborah Westmoreland. He nowadays, actually, he lives in Raleigh, and he set up a group there called SIG, Self-Inquiry Group, in Raleigh in North Carolina. So he has a group there, which Bart and Deborah do a self-inquiry intensive, like weekend or retreat or something, where they really do the thing of asking questions and digging deeply and so on. So Bart and Deborah are going to come in September and do a weekend intensive self-inquiry workshop here in Galway. Now, for myself, I actually have been doing, over the last year or something, we had meetings, a small number of people here who are interested in this. We've been having meetings every Thursday, but I cancelled everything. I just had to cancel everything when Seamus became ill in March. And I really, in September, I'm going to get back to work. But in the meantime, I do have my website and people can write to me on that. And I have email dialogue with people. And I found that to be so effective myself. I mean, basically, Art doing emails with me. Asking you questions. I occasionally take Skype calls from people, but I think probably not much until about September, because I have a lot of reorganization to do in my life now over this period. You know, there's things to be done in relation to Seamus' passing.
Yes, and I saw you were selling your car.
Yeah, there are things like that that come up that have to be done. There's, preoccupied with that reorganization and readjustment and so on for the time being. So
wonderful. Well, I wondered if anybody had any questions that they would like to ask, or people have been fairly quiet, but I know that they're listening because they've been writing things about just recognizing that what you're saying is very, very much the same kind of work that we all do. I don't want to say all of us, but most everyone who comes here is doing some work in this same nature. So it's just so heartening to hear that that it actually works.
And Bart has a wonderful phrase. He says, you know, leaving yourself, making yourself vulnerable to grace. We can't demand that grace comes or call upon it, but to do what we can to leave ourselves vulnerable to grace. I think it's a lovely expression.
That is beautiful. All right. So if anybody has any questions, you know, I know it's awfully late where Tess is. It's now at, 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you're probably tired of talking. There's a lot of talking going on today with us. But I wanted to thank you so much, Tess Hughes, for agreeing to be here, for sharing your heart with us. And, you know, I know I have seen you come into this room at least once before, and you are absolutely welcome to come in any time. And you may have to reload Pal Talk because they changed it. But otherwise, I would love to have you, if you just want to just pop in and say hi sometime, it'd be great, and I appreciate it very much. So do you have any questions for me?
No, but I want to say thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to share this and to talk about this, because I gained so much myself. I mean, courage and hope and information about the kind of things that, you know, might be helpful from other people speaking about this. I think it's very helpful. I benefited, as I said, from other people sharing their story on what happened. And, of course, I would hope that people would benefit from what I have had to say. And if anybody, you know, would like to ask me questions, they're welcome to email me. And you just go to my website, tesshughes.com, and you can contact me through that. And we could speak that way. I think it's probably the best way for the moment. And again, thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much, and God bless you. You're such a dear heart, and I really do appreciate you. And I will be talking to you again, because now I have a connection.
I'll say bye-bye to you in Irish, will I?
Yes, please.
Slán go fóill. Slán go fóill. Bye-bye for now.
Bye-bye for now. Thank you so much, beautiful Tess Hughes. All right. And Tess, if you want to stay on the line for just a moment, I'm going to turn off.